Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me today. Coming up over the next half hour, they're one of the oldest Christian communities in the Middle East, and now they're threatened with extinction. What's making Iraq's Christians run for their lives? And the difficult and increasingly dangerous decision to become Christian in Islamic nations. We talked to an expert in Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations. Non-stop sectarian violence has driven many Iraqis out of their homes. But while the international media is focusing on how the bloodshed is affecting Sunnis and Shiites, no one seems to be talking about the tiny Christian community, one of the oldest in the Middle East. And without their own militias like the other groups, Iraqi Christians are the most defenseless victims in the carnage. They've been targeted with a cruel string of kidnappings and killings of religious and attacks on churches. Christians are being forced to pay so-called protection money to armed groups of all sorts, with little guarantee that they'll really be protected. More and more over the last few months, most Iraqi Christians are refusing to talk to the media, even to us here at Vatican Radio. They're simply too afraid. One top Iraqi prelate I talked with here in Rome just last week confided to me that they are listening to everything we Christians say to the press. Retaliation is just a bomb blast or kidnapping away. Well, Christians have been held hostage in exchange for exorbitant sums. Families have been forced to sell everything they have in the hope they'll get their loved ones back. Others have been told in no uncertain terms to convert to Islam or to leave the country where they and their ancestors had lived for nearly 2,000 years. And many are leaving the violence and everything they own behind for an unknown future in an unknown country. Each month, Christians are among the 40 to 50,000 Iraqis who flee their homes. Though they account for just 3% of Iraq's entire population, Christians make up a full one-third of all Iraqi refugees. The figures are staggering. 2 million Iraqis are now displaced within their own country. Most have gone north to safer Kurdish areas. Another 2 million are believed to have fled to nearby nations. Syria alone says 1.4 million Iraqis have taken refuge in its territory over the last 3 years. Author and photographer Kai Weidenhofer has lived in the Middle East for decades. He recently returned to Europe from Damascus, where he met many of the Christian Iraqi refugees living in squalid camps and makeshift shelters. He told some of their stories to Paul Anthem.
Kai showed me the copy of a letter sent to one Christian family. It reads, "This is the last and final warning to you and all infidels and traitors like you. You have to leave Iraq and emigrate to people similar to you or renounce your religion. If you don't do this and disobey, your blood will be spilled. This fate will meet you after 72 hours.
It's a family that lived in an area of Baghdad, and yeah, they got a threat letter from a Shiite militia that they have to leave the area in 72 hours, otherwise they basically would get killed. I read a little bit of this letter. You have to leave Iraq and emigrate to people similar to you and the other Christian monkeys and pigs, or renounce your religion. It's signed by the Sharia court of the secret Islamic army. And these things are really serious, you know, it's not something you can joke around. They really go after the people."
Kai reveals the story of another Iraqi woman and the events that saw her managing to sell her house, yet fleeing Baghdad penniless.
And I talked to one Christian family, actually two to a woman. Her husband disappeared. He's not known where he is now. And she managed to sell her house for about $42,000 in Baghdad. And the next day, a son of her got abducted. And basically, so the abductors basically got all this money from the house, the $42,000. And then and the woman just took her family and drove off to Damascus as fast as she could, you know.
So she had nothing, basically?
No, she has nothing. No, she had nothing, you know.
So what was she doing? Where was she living? How was she managing to survive?
Well, she gets some support from a Christian church. That's it in the moment, you know. I mean, the UNHCR will hopefully get more active. Syria has only 22 million inhabitants, and they're basically a third world country, you know. I mean, they are not economically very powerful, so they have to deal with this influx of refugees. And of these refugees, about 30% is Shiite, 30% is Sunni, and about something like 35% are Christians. And the point is that the Christians actually build only 35% of the refugee community. They are only 3% of the population in Iraq. But they don't live, let's say, into neighborhoods where they really can protect themselves. So they crisscross the country and they cannot build up militias or really places where they can protect themselves. So it's very easy for Sunni or Shiite people to intimidate them out of their places. So they basically take what they have in their hands and then they just leave, you know.
While stories such as these arouse equal amounts of pity and disgust, others seem almost too disturbing to be true. Take the story of one young Iraqi man whose abductors handed him a stamped receipt after he paid his own ransom.
It's also a big mafia, you know. And once you have this receipt, basically, and the people grab you next time, they see, money is taken already. The guy is worthless, you know. Because, you know, they can always, I mean, people try to get, once somebody is abducted, they try to get some money from neighbors, from friends or whatever, you know. But you cannot do this two or three times because an amount of, let's say, mostly between 10 and 30,000 US dollars is a huge amount of money for these people, you know. So you can do it once, but the second time the people simply don't have the money.
Kai said abductions are big business now, and receipts are actually in the victim's own interest, as they convey to potential future abductors that there is no money to be taken from their would-be victims. How did you feel about the psychological, the mental state of these people? Were you amazed because they were so articulate, because they were still so devout in their faith, or were they in a complete, I mean, were they just completely destroyed by what had happened? How did you actually find them psychologically?
Well, psychologically, they are destroyed, you know. I mean, this is not, you know, the point is also, I think the Iraqi Christians is maybe the oldest or one of the oldest Christian communities in the world, you know. I mean, they even speak Aramaic. And I was at the Christmas service, it was so funny to see, you know, that the liturgy is still in Aramaic because it's a Chaldean church. And you could easily figure out, because all the people who came from Iraq, they could still speak Aramaic. But they actually followed the liturgy, while the Syrians couldn't, you know.
This was in Damascus?
Yeah, that was in Damascus, in the church, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's not, they cannot stay, you know, so it's not about being devoted to your faith or not. I mean, there's no choice, you know. They have to go.
How do you feel about the fact that people need to remember this kind of thing? Because every day the headlines are about people being killed in Baghdad and injured in Baghdad, and that is obviously tragic, but there's a whole forgotten side to this war, isn't there, in terms of, you know, a third of Christians, and not just Christians, but the amount of people being forced from their homes and then an uncertain future and a life of poverty and a life even worse. How do you assess the sort of importance of actually keeping this in the public eye?
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, it's just like about 10% of the Iraqi population are refugees now, you know, which is a lot, you know. It's about, altogether, about 2.5-3 million people who are just, I mean, are either internally displaced, so they went to the Kurdish areas because they are more safe, or they went to Jordan, or they went to Syria, or are on the way to Iraq.
What stuck most in your mind, Kai, from your visit when you got back? What stayed with you the most?
It's just this injustice, you know, and it's also the Bush government talks about Christian values, you know, and what they actually manage is to wipe out, I mean, to uproot one of the oldest Christian communities in the Middle East, you know, and they cannot go back. Once these people are out, I think it will be very, very hard that they can go back.
Author and photographer Kai Wiedenhofer. Well, when U.S. President George Bush was here for his first visit with Pope Benedict XVI, the Holy Father asked him to see that Iraq's Christians would be protected, whether by U.S. troops in Iraq or by Iraq's beleaguered government. What government? Quipped the unnamed Iraqi prelate I spoke to here in Rome. No one, he said, is protecting us, and no one is listening. Well, there are people listening here in the church. The problem is, are the people who can make a difference prepared to do something about protecting Christians in Iraq? Well, Susie Hodges spoke to Iraqi Bishop Philip Najim, the Holy See's representative for the Chaldean Church in Iraq. He's got some tough words about the violence against Christians in his homeland. Persecution akin to genocide.
It's the forced immigration from the areas of Baghdad for the Christian people, doing it day by day. They are killing a lot of Christian people. They are forcing the Christian people to convert to Islam. If they are not, they are obliged to pay some amount of money monthly to stay as they are. But even that, they are not safe. So a lot of Christian people, they are leaving their homes, which is from a long time they've been living in there, and they are suffering, and they are immigrated all over the country.
So when it comes to the situation regarding Christians or indeed other minorities, you think it's now evolved and it's become a generalized persecution of them rather than sporadic acts of violence against Christian targets?
It is an act of violence. It is a persecution. It is a genocide for the Christian community because, as you heard, they killed the second priest in Iraq. He was 34 years old with the three deacons. And they kidnapped after that another priest. So what they are doing now to threaten the Christian community to leave the country. And I think there is something systematic. It's not casual what they are doing against the Christian community in Iraq, the whole Christian community in Iraq.
You said, in fact, again recently, that you believe that Christian church in Iraq is dying. I mean, can it survive if there is no change in the current situation, in your view?
If the international community, they will never interfere, you know, for this matter, we will die because we fear we are alone. We feel it's no protection for us. And our people is leaving the country day by day, and they've been forced to leave their homes. So we don't feel any help from any international community or any opinion.
So Iraqis basically feel really disappointed that the international community has kind of abandoned them to their fate, is not doing more to speak out against this situation.
Actually, you are right. The whole Iraqi community, they are disappointed because they've been left alone. Nobody is talking about them. Even if we are hearing at the news every day, hundreds and hundreds of people they're being killed. But specifically, we are talking about the Christian community. Is nobody thinking about us, nobody helping us, nobody even care about us. So that's why the Christian community actually in Iraq, they feel by their own, is no help from the international community. It's no human conscience which they can think about them and save them. And nobody till now criticized the situation and what's happening against the Christian in Iraq, even the mass media. The mass media, what they are doing now, they are only talking about the situation in Iraq and what is happening to the Christian people in Iraq. They are not talking about any solution. They are not condemning the killing of the priest, the persecution of the Christian community, and the forced immigration for the Christian people from Iraq. Is nobody talking about it?
What about the coalition troops who are there on the ground? Aren't they doing anything to prevent attacks against Christians? I mean, have the Christians asked them?
We asked them several times, and they promised us to do their best, but we don't see any sign from their help. I'm telling you, we are totally left alone. They are killing the Christian church in Iraq day by day, and nobody from the international community, from the United Nations, all humanitarian organizations, nobody is talking about it.
Apart from being threatened, forced to pay a tax, is it true that many Christian families have been told that they have to marry their daughters to Islamic fighters? Is this a widespread threat as well?
Yes, it is correct, but it's correct in a way because, first of all, they are asking them to give a daughter from the family. If they will refuse to give this daughter to the Muslim, say, integralist, they have to pay amount of money at the front of this girl just to not give it to these Islamic terrorists.
Those who are being forced to flee the country because of these threats, are they forced to flee with basically only the clothes on their back?
This is correct because they are leaving behind their homes and their jobs and their belongings. And these homes and these jobs and these belongings, they are taken by the extremist and the integralist in Iraq, which I don't think they are an Iraqi Muslim, because an Iraqi Muslim, we've been living for with each other, you know, since a long time. There is a tolerance between each other, you know. We always been living as brothers. And I don't think what is happening these days, it's happening by the Muslim, the Iraqi Muslims itself. I think they are forces from outside. They are coming in Iraq to create these divisions and to create this threat.
How many Catholic churches in Iraq are closed now because of these attacks or threatened attacks?
We are talking about Mosul, which is approximately 500 kilometers north from Baghdad. And Baghdad itself, there are so many churches that are closed in Baghdad. So many priests have been kidnapped and been killed. And the Christian community, they are paying for that also, the poor people, the innocent people, which they don't have nothing to do with it. They don't know even why they are treating them like this. They are leaving their homes and they are leaving the areas.
And so what percentage of churches are still operating in Baghdad, for instance?
It's about 6 or 7, not more than that.
And is it true that some of the Christian neighborhoods now are living under a virtual state of siege, too frightened to go out?
Yes, so many of them, yes. Many of them, they are living also inside the churches because they've been forced to leave their homes.
And how many are left? I mean, I know that more than half of the original Christian population in Iraq that was there before the US-led campaign have now fled. Is that true?
Well, we can't give the exact number, but as we know, there are hundreds of thousands of them. They are leaving the country because they don't fear any protection either from the government or the American forces or the international community. That's why I'm telling you we feel we are alone.
So if you could describe the morale of the Iraqis, those that are left in the country, how would you describe it?
Well, their morale is down and they are suffering. Some of them, they can't even pay the rent to have a shelter, you know, and the church is paralyzed.
Do they see any light at the end of the tunnel?
I don't think so. If the international community are not going to interfere to stop this genocide against the whole Iraqi population, Iraq, it's gone. الرب ستر
لك. Bishop Philip Najim is the Holy See's representative for the Chaldean Church in Iraq. He was speaking there to my colleague Susie Hodges. Recently, a Christian was beheaded in India's troubled Kashmir region. Another was killed for his faith in Pakistan. Both were converts from Islam. And as we've seen in Turkey and other nations too, they're part of a disturbing list of Christians dying for their belief. And that list is growing. Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir teaches Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at St. Joseph's University in Beirut, Lebanon.
You remember the story of Abdul Rahman, this Afghan from Afghanistan who was working in Germany and then came back 2 years ago when the Taliban left Afghanistan, and he wanted to see his two daughters and then his own family denounced him as a converted, and he said, yes, I am Christian. And so they decided to kill him as a punishment. And then the West intervened, and they asked for his liberation, and finally he was protected, and he came to Italy. And they, if he escaped to this punishment, it's because they said he is crazy. He does not know what he is doing, because becoming Christian means to be crazy.
Does this mean that all Islamic law says it's okay to kill a Muslim who converts to Christianity? Who'd be crazy enough to do it then? Father Samir says that's too simplistic. It depends on who is interpreting what in Islam.
In the Quran, we find 14 verses speaking about this situation. It's always considered as something very bad, but never, never we find a condemnation to death. And this is the difference between the Sharia and the Quran. Quran is the most important pillar of Islam. The Sharia is written 3-4 centuries later and is based on Quran principally, but also on other elements, sayings or deeds of Muhammad. And we are never sure that these sayings attributed to Muhammad are really from him. The fact is that we don't find a single verse condemning an apostate to death. But in fact, they decided.
Who wrote the Sharia? You say it was written 3 or 4 centuries after the Quran, which would have put it, the Sharia, in about the year 1000,
the ninth, tenth century. Now, around the year 900. Who wrote it? These are famous jurists. 4 of them are considered as the heads of the 4 Islamic juridical traditions. There is also a 5th one, which is by the Shia, and they call it Ja'fari. And the 4 well-known Sunni jurists created the 4 schools, juridical schools of Islam. Now, these schools are based on the Quran, essentially reinterpreted according to the sayings attributed to Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, and with a personal interpretation.
Father Samir says these interpretations have many Muslim scholars questioning the application of Sharia law in their societies, but they're in conflict with those Muslims who take the more radical view.
The reason why most Muslims consider that an apostate, someone who abandoned Islam to move to another religion, must be killed, is that they say he's a traitor to his nation. And they say, you too, in the West, you will kill a spy, for instance, who traitored his own nation and gave secrets to the enemies. So we do the same. But by saying that, by giving this argument, it means that they considered the problem politically, and in fact is a political question. They say this punishment aims to make other people reject any move to another religion, essentially to Christianity. So it's a political punishment. And the question is, what do you do with the liberty of conscience? Here is the conflict about this. As I said, many scholars are now discussing this. Most nations, Muslim nations, renounced to kill the apostate. Most of them. Out of the 57 nations, if I'm not wrong, only 7 or 8 will apply this rule of the Sharia rigorously. The others will find another punishment. It's always punished. No one, even the secular countries like Turkey and Tunisia, for instance, in these countries, it will be still very difficult to convert from Islam to another religion. They all always considered he is a traitor, he must be punished in a way or in another way.
But, Father Samir adds, punishment has a religious element too, taken to the extreme by Muslim radicals.
In the Quran and in the Muslim tradition, the idea of punishment is considered as a purification. We kill him to purify him from his sin. This is the most radical tendency in Islam.
But how representative is this radical element in the Muslim world? Father Samir notes, there is a growing tendency towards fundamentalism, though few Muslims, he says, would resort to the kind of radical violence we've seen over the past couple of decades.
This radicality with violence, these represent a very, very small part of it, less than 1%. But the fact is that the radical tendency push those who are violent to they justify their violence. So you have most Muslims will not agree. 80% will not agree. Maybe 20% will say, well, is justified. But out of these 20%, 99% will never do it. There is an internal conflict between the rule, the Sharia, and that's why they say according to Sharia, he must be killed, and the act itself, they will never do it. But you find some radical, fanatical people who would say, the Sharia says he must be killed, so I do it.
Father Samir wants to see countries in East and West put basic human rights first. And no matter how guilty they may feel for their colonial pasts, he says, European countries should be among the first to spearhead efforts to push for the refining and strengthening of internationally recognized human rights for the dignity of every human being. Thanks there to Father Samir Khalil Samir, who teaches Islamic studies and Christian-Muslim relations at St. Joseph's University in Beirut, Lebanon. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.